to help us understand the world around us this time at the cellular level. Dr. Ulf Isaacson, doing my best not speaking Swedish, is professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School, where he's a principal faculty member at the Harvard Stem Cell Institute and director of the Center for Neuroregeneration Research at the Harvard-affiliated McLean Hospital. He received his undergraduate and medical degrees from the University of Lund in Sweden, and he's the winner of numerous awards, grants, and lectureships, and the author or co-author of over 200 scientific research publications in neuroscience and neurology, as well as 3 books in the field. Over the last decade, his original laboratory has grown to an internationally recognized academic research center for Parkinson's disease and related disorders, funded by the National Institutes of Health, Department of Defense, and private foundations. So it's my great privilege to welcome Dr. Isaacson to the Blasey Center to speak with us today about his work with stem cells and more broadly about the relationship between science and ethics on this question. Thanks.
Thank you very for introducing me to your center. You were persistent enough to get me as a speaker, and I appreciate your effort because it's not normally what I do, but it's important that I get to speak to your group and understanding what you're interested in. So, in my brief introduction, it's really just a preamble to understand what kind of issues that you would like to learn about. I obviously could tell you pretty much everything you'd like to know about stem cells, and I could speak about that for a long time, but I thought instead maybe assuming that you know some of the basics. In fact, newspapers tend to do a pretty good job in this field and outline the biology. So I thought I'd just perhaps tell you a little bit of how my work started so you understand perhaps why people are not interested in this. And then I will probably start specifying again a little bit what you can find in newspapers about the different types of stem cells. And then I'm really just interested in having a dialogue with you. Time usually flies by. So yes, I'm an immigrant and I'm Scandinavian, so it's really the beginning of your presentation next week. And it actually serves some purpose what Eric said. So I come from a place where people were working on these methods that involve cell therapy. So I was a graduate student then, and we discovered that instead of giving drugs to rats to cure them from Parkinson's disease, we could actually implant the cells, nerve cells, neurons that produce the missing substance. So in Parkinsonian rats, you can make them much better. And actually, the rationale for using cells is a very dominant one for me, because it, in my hands and in several other scientists, they work better than drugs, because cells are biological units and they have feedback systems. So they release the drug here, the dopamine, it's called dopamine, the substance that's missing in Parkinson's brain, better than what you can do with a pill. So there's a medical reason here, a rationale for this kind of work. And once we discovered this in the laboratory in the early 80s, and we were like 3 graduate students and some very, very prominent professors, and 2 graduate students in particular. And this work went very fast. We discovered that we could implant cells for aging, Alzheimer's disease, and Huntington's disease. And the principle was the same. But the cells we implanted were actually very immature nerve cells, a bit like seeds, the seed analogy to flower. So a nerve cell is best defined in the fetus. Cells grow, as we will talk about later, from anaerobic stem cells, and they become more and more what we call differentiated, so more and more defined. And they divide a lot. They're totipotent. It's a word you need to know, which means every potency. I'm sure it's a theological word, perhaps even originally thinking about who would be that totipotent. But the cells are totipotent because they can become any cell in the body. They have not yet got any instruction. And over time, as the body is formed, these cells become more specialized, and eventually get nerve cells. And so if you work in a laboratory and there are thousands of laboratory tissues every day, you can take a mouse fetus and basically dissect at the time when the cells have been born and put them back in a cell culture dish. This is non-controversial. So we did that and used those cells to basically repopulate the brains of animals that we knew had the model of the disease. Eventually, even in my brief graduate period, people started asking, now, well, this seems to work very well for Parkinson's disease. Now, when are you going to do this for humans? I remember my professor said, well, you know, we do science and we don't do this kind of thing. But he was also an MD. But my other fellow graduate student who was a little bit more interested in the clinical pararius, he had relatives with the disease. He said, I want to try. And so there was sort of a consensus in the Swedish way, you know, that this was, you know, reasonable. And since elective abortion is not an issue in Sweden, actually almost nobody thinks of that as an issue, which depends on what your emotional position is. It was decided by research committees at the University of Lund that, you know, this was reasonable and they would try it. So, same methods we had used in the... I wasn't actually doing that work myself because I had already moved to Cambridge, England by that time. But they did this and implanted the first patients with these cells. And as with a lot of medical progress, this occurred in the late 80s, early 90s. And it took a while because just like with the seed flower analogy, actually now you don't get the drug benefit right away. The cells have to take, they start growing connections called synapses. And about 9 months to a year after you've implanted the cells, the patients start to show improvements, which is very different than most doctors are used to, even with, you know, a heart transplant, it's immediate. But these cells grew and connected. So I particularly remember the papers that came out around 1993 in which patients had improved over a 3-year period. And, you know, we felt like, wow, this really works. But we all thought, actually, all the people in the field said, well, this is not going to be a medically applicable technology. Nobody is going to dissect human fetuses online to create, a large-scale therapies. And in Sweden, where this was completely non-controversial, there has been, I believe, 15 patients transplanted in the last 15 years. And most of those were transplanted in the early 90s. So, and the team I work much more with, the Canadian team in Halifax, which also have learned the technique that I helped develop, actually. They've done also about 15 patients in 15 years. So, the more sophisticated teams have done not perhaps more than 35, 40 patients in a long, long time. So this is really, really new technology in medicine and biology. Even at we're talking not even stem. I mean, I mentioned stem cells, but we were talking about the other cell type, right? The seed that's already defined. But I transgressed a little bit. But what is the next? What's the next achievement for us? Was to find a cell that was not fecal. And of course, there was a lot of religious and political issues about this. I'm not going to go into that. There was laws against it. Couldn't do it. One president said yes, the other one said no, and finally that was overturned. People could use fecal cells in the United States in this kind of research. But we recognized it wasn't really going to be applicable to a number of patients, so instead we tried, and this sounds a little bit odd, but we tried animal sources. So on a cellular level, humans and other species are somewhat related. And in fact, if you transfer nerve cells as an individual nerve cell, it is quite easy to reconnect even brains between different species. And I know this might sound very weird or scary, but on a cellular level, you know, I mean, people did in the war, remember? People took skin from pig cells, from pigs, and they put it on lots of wounded soldiers in the Second World War. Now, that was, it didn't work very well, but it was certainly grafting of pig tissue, and this has actually been written up, I think, and also in theological, I vaguely remember that people were talking about this, right? I mean, was the animal idea, I don't know what you're thinking now, but was that transferred onto the soldier with a wound? Well, nobody had any evidence of that, they used to say. In fact, I think the Catholic Church said at that time that was okay. It was a pope who actually said that, you know, you can actually do this, because I remember having to go to a meeting and somebody said, look, Pope so-and-so said that this is okay. You know, it doesn't transfer animal spirits. So what we did was to take pig cells, fetal cells, same type, and transplant that into animal. It worked very well. And the FDA at the time said, you know what, you can do this also in a small clinical trial. We did here in Boston and it turned out that we had missed one immunological difference between species, namely that humans and primates have natural antibodies to pig cells. So when you implant the cells, they get rejected at a much higher rate than in our animal models in mice. So we failed and succeeded sort of at the same time. We succeeded with some patients improving for a while, one patient in particular I remember who had benefit maybe for 7 months, but eventually all the patients lost those cells by rejection. So now that opportunity was gone. Doesn't mean that in the future somebody won't re-engineer those cells. You can humanize an animal cell by taking off some of the surface markers. The next thing that happened in my lab, so I'm kind of like a good measure for this, was in 1995 somebody said to me, look, you know about stem cells? I said, no, I don't. Because I work on nerve cells. And he was from MIT and he said, look, I put these substances like this, call it retinoid, retinol. It's, for those of you who have skin creams there's already knobs around the table here. Yeah. The dermatologist will know that retinol in your skin cream makes your skin better. Yeah. It makes the skin cell actually start what we call differentiate again. It grows a little bit more fresh skin, so people put it on their faces and their wrinkles go away. if you drop this substance, can you believe this, onto stem cells, mouse stem cells, and I remember this like it was yesterday, they wait a couple of days, and suddenly you can get cells that grow in batches, small, I mean we're talking microscopy now, so it's a little cell dish. If you look at the microscope, you get beating heart cells. And I remember talking to this one gentleman who was working at Charlestown Navy Yard at MGH. He said, look at this, it's beating. I said, wow. And next to it was a bunch of nerve cells, and you know, I did medicine, but you know, I was by now very, very specialized in neuroscience. So Jonathan Dinsmore said, look, you know, we really got to try this for Huntington's disease. I said, well, you know, I did my thesis on Huntington's disease. These cells don't look like those cells. Said, but they have the same transmitter, you know. In my field, we can distinguish hair-fine differences between cells that most people who are not in our field wouldn't be able to tell the difference. So a nerve cell is not a nerve cell to me. There are thousands of different types. But nonetheless, it was right in that respect. So we transferred the cells to a Huntington's disease model. And I was right. It didn't work. But he was right in a sense, too, that it was the right thing to do. And I was running through my Swedish training of doing the right experiment, the right control experiments, not putting in the substance, the retinol. And to my greatest surprise, almost great surprise, and to my postdoc surprise, we of course got what's known as the teratoma. When you don't tell a cell what to do, it becomes any cell in the body. But one more thing happened that I didn't expect. Namely, many of the cells became nerve cells. It's called, this is high-level biology, it's called a spontaneous default pathway. It's one of the most counterintuitive things in biology that I know. And Doug Malcolm, who's the head of the Stem Cell Institute at Harvard, said, if you don't tell a cell what to do, it becomes a nerve cell. It's like saying, okay, if you don't tell an engine what to become, it becomes a car. And so nerve cells are very, very complex cells. But actually, the biology of this is that the very, very early ball of cells actually keeps an inhibition of other cells to not become nerve cells. And those cells that are not activated, you have to actively inhibit cells not to become nerve cells. When you take away the inhibition, they become other cells. But so anyway, so I was very surprised. And I published this paper in 1998. And most of all, the biggest surprise of all was a gift, was that this main cell in this bunch was the dopamine cell that I'd been looking for decades. So I couldn't believe my luck. And I was publishing this paper nobody really paid attention to in 1998. But then, of course, I started to think about the problem, and I used a little bit of an understanding of this biology of this. So I isolated the cells so they couldn't talk to each other, and they defaulted. Because it's the signal between cells that creates the other tissue. So they were isolated and therefore non-inhibited. So they actually all become nerve cells. So I used this as a method. In 2002, I published a paper in the National Academy of Sciences that showed that these dopamine cells worked and that could again cure a rat of Parkinson's disease. By now, this was the hottest news in biology. There was a paper in Nature that followed ours, actually, which was very highly cited too. And by now everybody was talking about stem cells in that way that we now kind of think about it. And the ethical issues arose to it. Already before that, in 2001, President Bush had said that all satellites created after, not before, but after, I shouldn't even make fun of this, but after August 9, they were immoral, illegal. And before August 9, they were okay. So you could use satellites if you had created the day before. I was actually in Lund at that time. I got a phone call from a journalist saying, what do you think about this? And I remember standing in a square thinking, I don't really know what I think about this. But joke aside, it was a decision then that influenced our work. And as a consequence, California Institute of Research Medicine was formed a little bit later, and the Harvard Stem Cell Institute was formed because the states decided. Many people, as you know, 70%, I believe, the polls are that 70% of Americans between 60 and 70, independent of religious affiliation, think that using stem cells is okay, it's for medical purposes. So that brings me sort of to the current state. And since 2002, my team has worked very hard on using the legalized stem cells. We call them presidential lines. But it is fine. It makes most people laugh. Those presidential lines we are allowed to use. And what that means is that the government pays for the research if we can compete for the grants. And when I went to Germany, they always asked me in Europe, they asked me, why is your country not allowed to do this? And finally, I figured out what they're really asking me. They were trying to decide at the same time whether Germany should allow any stem cell. They thought that America had decided. In fact, nobody's that specialized, right? You would go to jail if you worked on stem cells. Actually, not true. And one of the many issues about this research is that it actually can proceed in companies without any legislation. And people have written who are interested in religion and ethics. Well, actually, universities are fairly well disciplined and have ethical committees about many things like that. Companies may not have as much transparency. So the law says, can't use government, federal money for this, but you can do it if it's not, nobody sues you. So I guess I'm not an expert on law either. So, but since 2002, my team has worked on human embryonic stem cells. We've managed to do what we did with the mouse cells. But human cells grow much slower. This is again a 101 for you. A mouse takes 21 days to grow to term, to be born from conception. 815 days, and humans only take about 9 months. So even when you do this in a dish now, it takes so much longer to grow the dopamine cells that we're wanting to find for our patients in a dish. It takes 42 days to grow them from those stem cells. So what is a stem cell? Is the most undefined stem cell, the embryonic stem cell, which is this cell line, really. Really, cell line means just cells that can proliferate indefinitely. Cancer is a cell line. If you have cancer and you put it in a dish, it will grow forever. It's a cell line. So an embryonic stem cell line is basically not a cancer cell line, we hope, but it can make any cell in the body. And when we start in the lab to grow it, on one day, we have to wait 42 days to get those dopamines. And we're experimentalists, meaning time matters to us in that sense. Our research depends on making discoveries, and it's very slow with human cells. So my team, can you imagine, from 2002, and I've had federal funding to this day, we're still struggling making the dopamine. We're very bad at it, I would say. Most people are not good at it yet. And it's very, very difficult scientific and biological challenge. So there's not going to be any patient work for the foreseeable future. What has happened, though, in the last 2 years or so, is that the stem cell work that we did has accelerated because we have started collaborating with scientists who have developed embryonic stem cells, embryonic stem cell-like cells from skin. So this is known by some scientists. It started by Yamanaka in Japan, and I remember listening to one of his postdocs, and I thought, this guy is wild. Because he was out there in a meeting in Germany talking about reprogramming. And I don't agree with his description, actually. Because he said, I reprogrammed the cell, and I thought, well, you haven't. You have deprogrammed. And why do I point this out to you? That what What you do with the skin cell when you want to deprogram it is that you take a skin cell and you insert genes that are active in the embryonic stem cells. Yamanaka used 4 genes. And when those 4 genes are turned on, it tells all the other genes that they need to deprogram. They take off all their previous instructions, and they basically become naked, and they have no instructions whatsoever. So they become like an embryonic stem cell. And once you express those 4 genes, you basically end up with a cell that has no identity. And I call that de-differentiation, because I did medicine. That's the process how you get cancer, because cancer cells are undifferentiated in many ways. So I thought Yamanaka's work was a little bit strange, but you know, science is what science is, and I was given cells by Rudolf Janisch, who's a scientist at MIT, mouse skin cells he had made into these cell lines. And 6 months ago, he gave them to me, and we have a paper coming out in the National Academy of Science on Tuesday, which is going to be highly publicized, in which we've managed to make the skin cells, the skin cell-derived stem cells, into dopamine neurons and cured our rats again. So I guess from the emotional positions people take, this is great news because they will not be controversial. But people will then, of course, ask, which you showed me an article about, is it in Science, is it Nature or some kind of blog? Yeah, some kind of
Nature.
Nature. That maybe this means that we don't need any embryonic stem cells, so nobody would have any issue about this anymore. And those writing thesis about it will have nothing, you know. But the more sophisticated view, I guess, is that actually this embryonic stem cell work we're currently doing is very important to us because we don't know how the skin cell is different from the embryonic stem cell. We call it epigenetics. Very strange term, actually. But it actually means how the genes are controlled. There are things that attach to a gene, so it can express or not express. And we call those methylation, acetylation. And that code is what your body has decided what genes to express. Environment has an influence. What we eat, how you develop. And so your symphonies in each cell is very special. And that epigenetic code is very important. By de-differentiation, the Yamanaka brain, I don't know, and I mean I don't know how different that is from a real stem cell. I don't know what the consequences will be long term. So while my lab will now be in the forefront in the news on Tuesday probably, then, or particularly Rudolf Janisch, who's the senior author, I'm the next to last. But my team was half the group. I actually don't know what it's, or I can say, okay, you know, studying human embryonic stem cells should end. I'm obviously in a position that it must progress because we don't know really how these cells work. And it could be a big mistake to abandon that research because we may end up not being at all medically helpful. So that's what I know. Any questions?
Great, well, this is a terrific introduction to the